Unfortunately,
has run into production problems. We have 34 manufacturers around the world who can produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so what they should do is to expand their manufacturing to include these manufacturers. Then we could actually make that vaccine work in the world. It would be good for them. It would be good for us.
Achal Prabhalo, we want to thank you so much for joining us from Bangalore, India. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
This is KBOO Community Radio. We're in our fall drive, exploring the sounds of democracy. Here at KBOO, we believe that, much like democracy, community radio is an ever-evolving experiment. As the needs of our communities grow and change, we remain true to our mission of uplifting underrepresented voices, playing local musicians, and keeping you updated with local news and current events. Show your support by donating right now at kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to 44321 or click Donate in the KBOO mobile app.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a Newburgh School District staff member is placed on leave after showing up to school in blackface. Pfizer says its COVID vaccine is safe and effective for kids age 5 to 11, and hundreds protest vaccine mandates at Oregon's Capitol over the weekend. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 20th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fun drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. A staff member in the Newburgh School District has been placed on leave after showing up to work in blackface last Friday. The Newburgh Graphic reports that the staff member, a special education assistant, dressed up as Rosa Parks in order to protest a vaccine mandate for teachers. The staff member reportedly darkened her skin with iodine. Vaccines are mandated for all K-12 employees in Oregon. The staff member was removed from school grounds and placed on administrative leave. A statement from the school district's website said, quote, "It is important to remember how blackface has been used to misrepresent Black communities and do harm. We acknowledge the violence this represents and the trauma it evokes, regardless of the intention," end quote. The Newburgh School District is already in the middle of two ongoing situations regarding racial discrimination. Last week, Newburgh High School's board confirmed that one of its students was facing potential punishment for participating in a racist Snapchat group that made light of slavery. Any punishment given to that student won't be made public unless the board is notified of an appeal. The school district also voted earlier this year to ban Black Lives Matter and LGBTQ plus pride flags at school and to ban staff from wearing BLM and pride attire while they're at work. Parents have said that their students don't feel safe at Newburgh High. In past public comments about the ban on Black Lives Matter and pride symbols, parents of Black students have said having Black Lives Matter displays in the school shows their students who they can turn to when they're experiencing racism. Pfizer says its coronavirus vaccine is safe and effective in children ages 5 to 11, according to its recent trials. The company plans to seek U.S. authorization for the age group soon. It would be a key step towards vaccinations for younger children, as kids are now back in school and the Delta variant is causing a jump in pediatric infections. For elementary school age kids, Pfizer tested a much lower dose, a third the amount that is in each shot that's given now. According to Pfizer, after their second dose, children ages 5 to 11 developed coronavirus-fighting antibody levels just as strong as teenagers and young adults, even with the lower dose. Pfizer says the dosage is safe with similar or fewer temporary side effects, such as sore arms, fevers, or achiness, that others have experienced. The company plans to apply to the Food and Drug Administration by the end of the month for emergency use in this age group, followed shortly afterward with applications to European and British regulators. Kids are at a lower risk of severe illness or death than older people from the coronavirus, but more than 5 million children in the U.S. have tested positive for COVID-19 since the pandemic began, and at least 460 have died, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Recently, cases in children have risen dramatically as the Delta variant sweeps through the country. A second U.S. vaccine maker, Moderna, is also studying its shots in elementary school-aged children. Both Pfizer and Moderna are studying even younger children as well, down to six-month-olds. Results are expected later in the year. Hundreds protested Oregon's vaccine and mask mandates in Salem over the weekend. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Some 1,000 protesters gathered at the Oregon Capitol in Salem on September 18th, rallying against COVID vaccination and mask mandates. Governor Brown had ordered healthcare and emergency service workers, teachers, and state employees to be vaccinated by October 18th. Members of each of those groups attended the protest. Brown also ordered a statewide outdoor mask mandate on August 24th. Protesters stated they did not want to give Brown or the state information about religious beliefs or their medical histories. They also said mandated medicine has no place in a free country. The rally was organized by Oregonians for Medical Freedom, a political action committee that works to protect vaccine exemptions. The rally was described as peaceful. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Nabisco workers in Northeast Portland have come to a tentative agreement on a new contract with their parent company, Mondelez International, ending a strike that began more than 5 weeks ago and spread across the country. Members of the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union voted to approve the contract proposal Thursday and Friday, despite workers in Portland urging members in other locations to vote against the deal, arguing that it still demanded too many concessions. However, the contract passed in Portland with roughly 75% approval. Workers in Portland first walked out of the Nabisco Bakery on Northeast Columbia Boulevard in August over a Mondelez contract offer that would have given new workers a lesser health care plan, shift certain employees to an alternative work week, and cut back overtime opportunities. They were then joined on strike by workers in four other Nabisco factories. The four-year contract that they've now tentatively approved contains several clear victories for the workers. The union's health care plan will remain unchanged, both for current employees and new hires, and there should also continue to be overtime opportunities for workers who want them. The contract does, however, allow for the formation of weekend crews, groups of workers that'll work three 12-hour shifts from Friday through Sunday or Sunday through Monday, and will be paid for a regular 40 hours of work. Workers can bid to be a part of the crew, and no one can be compelled to join it. The union was clear on one thing. The contract that was ultimately approved is leagues better than what Nabisco workers would be facing had they not gone on strike. Local 364 business manager Cameron Taylor said, quote, "In the 9 years we've been under Mondelez, this is the first time they have actually sat down and negotiated in good faith with our negotiating team, and it took them 5 weeks to do it. The strike sent a message to all corporations that workers are not going to get pushed around, even if these corporations are multi-billion dollar corporations," end quote. Many Hispanic households don't have regular access to the internet, which could be cutting people off from the digital economy. One initiative is showing how the country can tackle this issue. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A growing slice of the workforce is Hispanic, but a disproportionate number of Hispanic households don't have regular access to the internet. It could be cutting many off from the digital economy. An initiative is aiming to tackle this issue. In Oregon, the Hispanic population grew 30% between the 2010 and 2020 census, comprising 14% of the state's population. Diana Caba with the Hispanic Federation says one way to ensure people in these communities have the skills they need for the economy is to meet them where they are.
Recognizing that new technologies are dramatically changing the workforce requirements of our economy, for Latino nonprofits that are engaged in workforce training to best serve the needs of the people they train, the idea is to adapt the curriculum and develop capacity to prepare students and workers for the digital economy.
The Latino Digital Accelerator Initiative currently operates in 10 states, including Washington and California, but not yet in Oregon. However, the need is great across the nation. As many as one-third of Latino families don't have regular access to the Internet. Caba says the Latino Digital Accelerator Initiative started just before the COVID-19 pandemic, which presented a new challenge.
With the onset of the pandemic, that really led everyone from a panic to pivot moment of how do we administer these types of programs for the community, knowing that that's exactly what this initiative is there to address, the lack of digital skills that are found in the Latino community.
Caba says the future belongs to those who are connected. She says that applies not just to people looking to connect to educational resources like universities, but also for people who may be on less traditional paths like technical colleges and apprenticeships.
To be able to still access quality training that will lead to quality employment. That really, at the end of the day, is what this initiative boils down to.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Voters in Minneapolis, Minnesota are deciding the future of public safety. A recent poll found that 49% of Minneapolis residents support a proposal to replace the Minneapolis Police Department with a Department of Public Safety. With more on the story, it's Sophia Muhammad with the Racial Reckoning Project.
On Thursday evening, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in favor of the wording of the charter question on the Minneapolis ballot. The proposed amendment would replace the current Minneapolis Police Department with a Department of Public Safety.
This is an exciting time for the city of Minneapolis.
Minister Janae Bates is with Yes for Minneapolis, the group pushing for the charter change. Bates says the charter amendment has gained what she describes as manufactured controversy. She says people in power are telling lies to the public about the charter for their own self-interests.
They thought that they could take the votes from the over 100,000 people in Minneapolis who deserve to have a say about their public safety. And the Supreme Court ruled that to be false, that the people do have a right to vote on this important issue that they have fought long and hard for.
A recent poll taken by NPR, Star Tribune, Care 11, and Frontline Minnesota shows that 49% of Minneapolis residents support the proposal of a new Department of Public Safety. 40% oppose the proposal, 10% are undecided. Bates says she believes the people of Minneapolis will vote in a way that protects and advances their community.
The hope and prayer is that the people of Minneapolis lean into the best version of themselves, and quite frankly, that they vote their values around just being safe.
Opponents of the charter proposal say they want to keep the mandatory minimum staffing level for Minneapolis police. Early voting is open now in Minneapolis at the Office of Elections and Voter Services. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Sophia Muhammad.
A project on a Puget Sound island is creating a farmland commons to empower a new generation of farmers. The Agrarian Commons Program is launching in 12 sites across the country. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
A farming project on a Puget Sound island is looking to reshape agriculture and access to land. The nonprofit Agrarian Trust launched its Agrarian Commons project in 12 sites across the U.S. Puget Sound Agrarian Commons got its start in 2020 after a 12-acre farm gift on Whidbey Island. Addy Khadib is the Pacific Northwest Regional Director for American Farmland Trust and a board member on Puget Sound Agrarian Commons. Farmers who join the trust, Kandib says, will be part of the board and involved in decision-making on the property.
This is really trying to not just get farmers on the land, but to also empower them as thought partners and really having some power in the long-term stewardship of the land.
The commons recently opened up for proposal requests from farmers. The land currently is undeveloped. She says farmers who become part of the commons will use regenerative agriculture to create a resilient ecosystem. Kandib notes the majority of farm owners in the U.S. are older and white, and notes that as they retire, a large amount of land will change hands. Candeep says the Commons wants to support a new generation of farmers.
We also know that access to land is one of the biggest barriers that faces beginning farmers, and particularly beginning farmers who are people of color or who come from backgrounds where they historically have not had access to land.
Candeep believes the project is crucial for supporting the future of local agriculture.
If we want healthy, vibrant local food systems, we need to figure out how we get people who want to farm onto land in ways that are stable and secure and affordable so that people can really thrive in their chosen careers.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interview with author Tom Hartman on his book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare. We'll follow that up by Noise Filter, debunking the COVID-19 pandemic. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 55. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy. Today in history, in 1946, the first annual Cannes Film Festival opens on the French Riviera. The festival has come to be regarded as one of the most prestigious film festivals in the world, though many have criticized it as overly commercial. More than 30,000 people come to Cannes each May to attend the festival, about 100 times the number of film devotees who showed up for the first Cannes in 1946. The quote of the day is from American engineer, physician, and astronaut Mae Jemison, who was the first Black woman to travel into space. Jemison said, quote, "Never be limited by other people's limited imaginations." U.S. military apologizes for a drone strike that killed 10 Afghan civilians. The Justice for J6 rally in Washington, D.C. draws a small crowd, and the CDC says it will help public health departments. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We now assess that it is unlikely that the vehicle and those who died were associated with ISIS-K or were a direct threat to U.S. forces.
Commander General Kenneth McKenzie apologized for the deaths of 10 civilians, including 7 children killed in a U.S. drone strike August 29th in Kabul. The driver of the targeted vehicle, Zemurai Amadi, was a longtime employee at a humanitarian organization. The U.S. military says it mistakenly thought the vehicle was carrying ISIS-K fighters that posed a threat to evacuation efforts. Family members of the dead want compensation and an investigation and punishment for those responsible. Heightened fears about a Justice for J6 rally in Washington Saturday eased when the event fizzled. The Capitol rally, held in support of January 6th insurrection defendants, only drew a small crowd. Event organizer and former Trump campaign aide Matt Brainard.
This is about equal treatment under the law. This is about a public investigation into many of the things that happened that have not been investigated publicly, especially the death of Ashley Babbitt.
A review by Kaiser Health News found lawmakers in every state proposed legislation to curb public health powers during the pandemic. Most bills failed or were vetoed, but half of states enacted laws permanently weakening government health authority. Meanwhile, CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky says her organization is launching a $2.1 billion initiative to strengthen the nation's local health departments.
This includes improving laboratory capacity to detect infectious threats, training healthcare workers in a first-of-its-kind program, and expanding data so we can track infections real-time and monitor progress.
President Biden's COVID team says vaccination requirements are a cornerstone of combating the Delta variant. Jeff Zients, White House COVID-19 response coordinator, says Biden recently met with big employers, including Microsoft and Disney, who are working to implement worker vaccination rules.
Vaccination requirements work, and they're good for the economy. At United Airlines, the vaccination rate among employees has gone from 59% to 90% in just 6 weeks.
France has recalled its ambassadors to the United States and Australia in protest of a new agreement on the sale of nuclear-powered submarines. Australia broke an arms contract with France in favor of the U.S. deal, designed to push back on Chinese power in the region. Former state representative Beto O'Rourke is planning to run for Texas governor in 2022. A new poll shows the one-time presidential and Senate candidate still faces an uphill battle against Republican incumbent Greg Abbott. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Corvallis School District in Oregon changes school names. Indigenous people present at the Emmy Awards and women's advocates march to the Navajo Capitol. With those stories and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Corvallis School District has changed the name of 3 schools. They now honor people of color. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Last year, the Corvallis School Board approved a resolution to have 3 elementary schools drop the names of U.S. Presidents Thomas Jefferson, Woodrow Wilson, and Herbert Hoover. All 3 have pasts involving slavery or racism. The schools are now named for Bessie Coleman, the first Black and Indigenous woman to get a pilot's license, Letitia Carson, a Black woman who claimed land in Oregon despite state laws at the time, and Catherine Jones Harrison of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde, who's advocated for the restoration of tribal statuses and lands and education. School Board Co-Chair Lahui Whitebear.
There's a really strong tie to this area and with the local schools, so that's one of the reasons why her being chosen was so significant. Also, just the work that she has done throughout her life.
Among the influences cited for the name change was the Black Lives Matter movement. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
The co-creator and cast of Reservation Dogs presented at the 2021 Emmy Awards Sunday night, which aired live on CBS. Clips of their presentation talking about indigenous representation in Hollywood is being shared widely on social media. Co-creator Sterling Harjo took to the stage saying, "We're here on television's biggest night as creators and actors, proud to be indigenous people working in Hollywood.
Representing the first people to walk upon this continent. And we are really happy to be here.
Thankfully, networks and streamers are now beginning to produce and develop shows created by and starring indigenous people.
It's a good start, which can lead us to the day when telling stories from underserved communities will be the norm, not the exception."
Because like life, TV is at its best when we all have a voice.
The series Reservation Dogs on FX on Hulu follows the lives of indigenous teenagers in Oklahoma. Here's how Sterling Harjo described the series during an interview this summer on the talk show Native America Calling.
"What's amazing about this show is all of the writers and all the creators of the show are Native. And so we weren't afraid to just be like, yo, like we have interesting lives and we have interesting communities and we celebrate that. We tell it how it is. And I think that like having indigenous creators and indigenous directors like and writers, like I think that they're just like we were fearless in telling the story of who we are. And it's something that I've always wanted to do. It's something I've always strived to do in all of my work. It's just like kind of like not censoring ourselves because we're afraid of what white America will think about us. It's celebrating the fact that we're different and that our communities are different. Like that's the element that I feel like is different about this show."
Harjo and actors presented the Emmy for Outstanding Directing in a Limited Series. On Friday, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland signed the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes Water Rights Compact. It formally executes the Montana Water Rights Protection Act, enacted by Congress in December 2020. With the signature, the tribes can now begin to implement the compact. Tribal leaders say the compact will help protect water for future generations to come. Native women's advocates marched to the Navajo Nation Capitol in Window Rock, Arizona, Friday. Advocates are calling on the tribe's lawmakers and leaders to allocate funding to address sexual abuse and missing and murdered indigenous people. Advocates are also seeking the creation of a position to track crimes committed on the reservation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
An initiative aims to create a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty. It is inspired by the nuclear non-proliferation treaty negotiated in the 1960s. Dr. Anthony Lazowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the 1960s, the threat of nuclear war inspired nations to negotiate an international treaty to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons. Now, there's a similar growing call to prevent the spread of fossil fuels.
Today, fossil fuels are our nuclear weapons. They are what is threatening our health, our economic future, and our global security.
That's Zipporah Berman, chair of the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty Initiative. The group is calling for nations to develop a plan to stop producing fossil fuels and fully transition to clean, renewable energy. More than 400 organizations, 1,300 academics and researchers, and cities including Los Angeles and Barcelona have endorsed the initiative. Berman says the treaty is needed because, although many countries have set climate goals, few have taken serious steps to halt the production of fossil fuels.
Almost every single country will tell you that we can't stop producing oil, gas, and coal because other countries aren't. So we'll be uncompetitive.
She says an international treaty could help create a coordinated plan for countries to take this critical step together. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a special Fall Fun Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 20th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Sophia Muhammad, Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lazowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Times Like Now with Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews artist Julian Vossandre about trying to visualize quantum physics, immigrating from Germany to Portland, and switching from being a scientist to a full-time artist. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO is in our fall fun drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you'd like to contribute to KBOO, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for a special rebroadcast of our interview with author Tom Hartman about his book, The Hidden History of American Healthcare. Stay with us.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The United States is mired in a healthcare crisis, separate from the COVID pandemic. Our healthcare system, which is largely for profit, leaves many Americans without adequate coverage. It doesn't even perform better, as demonstrated by high rates of infant mortality and low life expectancy for Americans. I spoke about this with author Tom Hartman, who has what he describes as a simple solution for our healthcare problems, Medicare for all. Tom is a trained psychotherapist and a New York Times best-selling author of 32 books. He has a popular progressive talk radio show, also simulcast on TV in approximately 60 million North American homes. Tom has written multiple books in the Hidden History series, including The Hidden History of Guns and the Second Amendment and The Hidden History of the War on Voting. His next book is The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. We are lucky to have him on our program today.
Welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you. It's great talking to you again.
Tom, why did you write this book as part of your Hidden History series, and why now?
Right now, I think healthcare is probably more top of mind for a lot of people than any other time in our recent history, because we're experiencing a pandemic, and in the midst of this, we've got, you know, 30 or 40 million people who are under or uninsured, arguably, you know, well over 100 million people underinsured. And we're seeing bankruptcies from people getting sick just skyrocketing. They had been averaging around a half a million a year for the last couple of decades. And last year they were over 700,000. This year they'll be over a million. And these are mostly people who got sick with COVID and as a consequence have huge hospital bills or doctor bills that they can't pay and their insurance companies are only covering parts of. So I think that it's a really critical time to be having a conversation about how we reinvent our healthcare system so that it actually serves everybody in the country rather than just, you know, a few billionaires in the health insurance industry.
Did I correctly read that in the U.S. we have the worst of all worlds, healthcare that's more expensive and less effective, especially in terms of life expectancy?
That's true. That's absolutely true. And in fact, in terms of things like maternal mortality or child mortality, we are in third world category. We're below, I believe, all other developed countries. Possible there's one that we're competing with in those categories. The only area, which by the way is the area that you will find all over the internet being held up as proof that American healthcare is wonderful, the only area where we do better than most other countries in the world is breast cancer. And the only reason for that has nothing to do with our health insurance system or our medical care system. It has to do with the absolute extraordinary efforts over a period of about a decade and a half, two decades, of a group of very, very committed women raising consciousness about breast cancer and particularly teaching women how to do self-exam. So that's the one area in healthcare where we're doing well, and that's because of early diagnosis. But in every other realm, we pay anywhere from a third to twice as much, a third more to twice as much for health insurance and healthcare in general as any other country in the world. We pay about twice as much for pharmaceuticals as any other country in the world. And the average American family spends about $3,000 a year on healthcare that no other, you know, it's basically a tax that is not hit, that doesn't hit the residents of any other developed country in the world.
So I'm hoping you'll help us by defining a phrase you like and which our listeners have heard mentioned by some progressive political candidates. What exactly is Medicare for all?
Well, Medicare is a single-payer healthcare system. The single payer is the government, and all the bills come to one source, and that one source pays all the bills. Medicare, as it was put into place in the 1966 or 67, 65, I forget which year it was, but you know, when Medicare was put into place, was designed, Robert Ball, the guy who actually wrote the Medicare legislation, designed it so that with just literally changing a few sentences, it could become a national healthcare system, much like Canada had at that time. Canada's was called Medicare. It started in one province, Saskatchewan. Other provinces wanted it. They got it. Eventually, the federal government stepped in to backstop the individual provinces. My guess is that's probably how it's going to play out here in the United States. Right now, there is a law that prevents that from happening, that both California and Vermont have passed single-payer legislation, but they haven't been able to implement it, because if a state does that right now under current law, all Medicaid and Medicare money stops coming into the state, or at least the state can't reallocate it through their system. And that is a small change to law that has been proposed year after year after year by Democrats and progressives in Congress. And of course, the health insurance industry is fighting it tooth and nail. But, you know, that's what it is, single-payer health care, and hopefully that's how we'll get it.
So that leads into the next question. Is the term Medicare for All completely synonymous with single-payer health care, or is it one system that you are in favor of?
Well, it depends on whose definition you're using. Medicare itself is a single-payer system, but it only pays 80% of expenses. That was put into place in the 60s. It was a demand made by white racist Southern senators who did not want black people to have access to health care. Racism has been the principal animating force behind our lack of a comprehensive health care system in this country for over 100 years, as I document fairly exhaustively in the book. These white senators from the South wanted to make sure that if a poor black person got sick, which was the majority of black people at that time in the South, then they wouldn't be able to afford the copay, so they wouldn't go get care. And this goes back to the scientific racism theories of Frederick Hoffman, who toured the United States in the late 1800s and early 20th century, pitching his idea that if we simply denied health care to black people, they were so genetically inferior, they would all eventually die out. And that animated the AMA, that animated our policy, that became part of the reason why there's this 20% hole in Medicare in the 1960s. So if you really wanted it to be single payer, you have to do away with that 20% hole and have Medicare pay all expenses and then extend it to everybody in the country, which is, by the way, what is being proposed by the people who are the advocates of Medicare for All. But if we were to simply take our current Medicare system with its 20% hole, where you have to buy a private health insurance policy if you're over 65 to supplement, you know, it's called Medigap, to fill that gap, to supplement your Medicare policy, then I'm not quite sure you could call it single payer. It would be more like that's American Medicare. But like I said, Canada calls their single payer system Medicare, as do other countries. Pretty straightforward stuff.
Thanks. Have there been any serious previous efforts to develop Medicare for All?
There have been a bunch of previous efforts. Teddy Roosevelt pitched this in 1912. Franklin Roosevelt pitched it in 1936. Harry Truman pitched it in 1947. John Kennedy pitched it in 1961. In every case, the majority of the pushback that they got came from the insurance industry and from the white racist, mostly in the South, who did not want black people to have equal access to health care and were afraid that a national health care system would integrate the hospitals and doctor's offices, which was something they were able to succeed in preventing right up until the 1960s. So although Medicare has been the most successful racial integration program in history, in less than 1 year we integrated every hospital in America simply because those were the terms under which they would get the money. But, you know, we need to clean this up and tweak it a little better.
So I actually practiced cancer medicine in Canada for years, and I thought it was pretty wonderful. But people here always point to the, oh, there are no blankets in hospitals, or say it takes 5 years to get a shoulder MRI under single-payer coverage. Do you think there truly are disadvantages like that with Medicare for All?
I think with any kind of medical system, you're going to have a difficult time load balancing supply and demand. When Louise and I moved to Washington, D.C. back about 12 years ago, we literally could not find a doctor in D.C., and Louise needed to get some medication that she needs to take on a daily basis. And every single medical practice, I mean, we called everybody. Louise spent days on the phone trying to find a doctor. Every doctor was filled up. I know when I needed back surgery, I had to jump through a whole lot of hoops and had to wait quite a while to get that back surgery. With Louise in D.C., we ended up going to a concierge practice, where you pay the doctor up front, you pay him a couple thousand dollars a year just to be your doctor, and then you go see them and they send you another bill, which is, by the way, spreading all across the United States now, because we have these huge shortages. We have areas in this country where there are doctor shortages, or at least GP shortages. There are other places where there's shortages in particular specialties. A national health care system will substantially ameliorate that, and stopping the cap on the number of people who can go to medical school in order to just, you know, artificially inflate the pay of docs is probably also a useful thing to do in the United States. So right now, as anybody who has had, you know, elective surgery can tell you, there are long waits, or there can be long waits in the United States, depending on the policy you have, depending on the part of the country you live in, and depending on, you know, how much money you're willing to kick in, or, you know, if you're willing to go to a place that charges a premium that you may have to pay. That's not a system that is lacking in
allocations or lacking in rationing, which is the word that they love to use. They say, oh, they ration Canada, ration healthcare in Canada. Well, we ration healthcare here in the United States. We just do it based on ability to pay rather than severity of medical condition. And I think severity of medical condition is really the appropriate point where you say, okay, this person has, a cancer at risk of metastasis. We're going to take that out tomorrow. Or this person has a broken bone. We're going to fix it this afternoon. Whereas that person has some arthritis in their hip, and sometime in the next year or two, they're going to need a hip replacement. Let's put that off 3 months before we start doing the preliminary work. That just makes sense to me.
Certainly everybody who needed frontline chemotherapy for colorectal cancer in Canada got it, which was wonderful for practitioners and for the patients.
Louise and I lived for 10 years or so in Vermont, right across the border from Canada. And there were not all kinds of Canadians coming to America looking for medical care. In fact, I never saw one. But every weekend in Montpelier, Vermont, where we lived, a bus would pull into the center of town, and older people, people on Medicare mostly, would fill the bus, and it would drive up north to Toronto to go to the pharmacies for people to pick up their prescriptions. We have such a dysfunctional system here. It's just shocking.
You compare taxes used to pay for health care to taxes that might be used to fund a fire department, for example. Do you think that argument resonates with opponents?
Well, I don't know about opponents. I'm not sure that any argument resonates with them. And this is a conversation that we haven't had in a big way in the United States really since the 1950s. And we really first started having in an honest way in the 1880s and 1890s when we went from private fire departments that only put out the fire on your house if you had their medallion on the front of your house, meaning you paid your fee to them every year, and private police departments in many parts of the country, and no public schools of any consequence, to by 1900 public schools being a thing that had spread out of Boston in the 1890s and across the country within a decade or two. And we kind of all agreed that, if your house is on fire, that's everybody's problem. That's a community problem. It's bigger than something you can individually deal with. Therefore, dealing with houses on fire should be considered part of the commons. If you've got a child that needs an education, that's something that's beyond the capability of most individuals, particularly if they have to work a job, and there's benefit to the entire community. So that's appropriately part of the commons being the things that we all collectively own and administer and fund. And I would say, if we've agreed for 100 years now that if your house is on fire, we will all collectively pay to get a fire department and a fire truck out there, isn't your body as valuable as a house? If your body is metaphorically on fire with, cancer or disease or injury, isn't that as urgent a consideration as somebody's house being on fire? It certainly seems that way to me. And I think now is the time to start saying healthcare should be part of our commons, just like fire and police are, and schools.
I think that leads beautifully to another question. You had a big chapter title with a big concept, healthcare, right or privilege? I think I can guess your answer, but would you like to explain it?
Well, that is really what it comes down to. I mean, in the United States, you have a right to an education. If you feel that your child is not being appropriately educated in school, you can literally sue the government. There are areas where we have very specific rights that we can enforce in court, but healthcare is not one of them, which, as I said, I think is crazy. Healthcare has been defined as a right by the United Nations. We signed that treaty defining it as a right. We just never applied it to our own country. Healthcare is defined as a right by 33 out of the 34 OECD countries, the richest countries in the world, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. We are the only one that doesn't recognize healthcare as a right. And I think that's morally criminal and, and a tragedy at a societal and a personal level. And really only serves to benefit the people who are just getting obscenely rich running these health insurance industry scams from Medicare Advantage on down to private health insurance.
Thanks. You had so many astonishing percentages and other figures. You said that 80% of Americans would have to borrow or beg for cash if they were hit with an unexpected, simple $1,000 expense. That scares me, and I presume our listeners. Can you explain how single-payer health care or Medicare for All help Americans avoid a financial crisis?
Well, it pays the bills. It's very straightforward. In some countries, you have medical or healthcare systems where there's a small deductible. You know, we may have that here, but right now, most Americans have health insurance policies that have deductibles and copays and whatnot that add up to multiple thousands of dollars a year. And in a country where 80% of the country can't deal with a $1,000 expense, half of the country can't deal with a $400 expense, that's just not sustainable.
So getting down to the nitty-gritty, you had a pretty radical-sounding solution. Have the government buy the insurance companies. How would that work? How would that help?
Well, one of the problems that we have right now is the Supreme Court has ruled on multiple occasions, Citizens United is the most well-known one, that if a corporation or a billionaire want to massively influence politics or even own a politician, that's not called corruption or bribery, that's called free speech, and it's protected by the First Amendment. As a consequence of that, when you try to take on a giant industry like the health insurance industry, or in this, the one that's playing out right in front of us right now is pharmaceuticals, you've got AARP saying, let's let the government negotiate drug prices for Medicare. And you've got the drug companies running ads on TV right now saying, whoa, if you let that happen, then we're not going to be able to get drugs to people on Medicare, which is just complete BS. So if there, or when there is a serious attempt to create Medicare for all, you can bet that this industry, where you've got a handful of companies, six, eight companies that are showing billion-dollar quarterly profits, multi-billion-dollar quarterly profits, who are paying hundreds of executives more than $1 million a year. These people will invest a few hundred million dollars, or maybe even $1 billion, in a nationwide ad campaign to take down any effort to do this. They did it back when Obama was doing Obamacare. They did it against Hillary Clinton back in 83, I think it was, or 93 rather. They will launch war. If you add up the market capitalization of the five or six largest health insurance companies, it comes to just a little over $1 trillion. By recollection, it's in the book. You've read it more recently. I wrote it a year ago. But it's about $1.1 trillion, something like that. If we just bought all their stock and said, okay, we own you now, and then just started retiring them and, you know, closing down their operations and moving it all over to Medicare and reallocating those employees, it may be a kind of a bloodless coup, as it were. It might be a lot more effective than trying to go to war with them and just drive them out of business.
What can supporters practically do to make Medicare for All happen?
Let your elected officials know that you support it, both at the local level, because I believe a lot of these initiatives are really going to start at the state level. So your state representative and your state senator or assembly person or whatever it may be. And then also let your one member of the House of Representatives and your two senators know. You know, we're very fortunate here in Oregon. You know, I'm represented by Earl Blumenauer, and of course we've got Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley in the Senate, and they are all advocates of single payer. I know that we have, you know, one Democrat who we're not really sure of, but we'll see. You know, we'll see. But we just need to let people know that this is a priority for us.
Importantly, where can readers find a copy of your book?
Any bookstore, any online source. It's distributed through all the normal channels.
Tom, do you have any final thoughts or items we didn't cover that you'd like to?
You know, Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Here we have this crisis caused by a pandemic, and it's causing people, I think many people for the first time, to realize that personal health and public health are interrelated. We need it. We need Medicare for All or single-payer health care now more than ever.
Tom, I want to thank you so much for being on KBOO News and Bits.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today we spoke with Tom Hartman, author of The Hidden History of American Healthcare, Why Sickness Bankrupts You and Makes Others Insanely Rich. In the book, Tom described the deplorable state of American healthcare and outlined his fix, Medicare for All. I was particularly struck by a phrase on his website. It is time for America to join every industrialized country in the world to make health a right, not a privilege. Let's hope that happens. For KBOO Community Radio, I'm Josh Salem. Thanks for listening.
My name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
COVID and RSV on the rise in children. There has been a steady rise of COVID cases and hospitalizations in children as the Delta variant does not discriminate based on age. Unfortunately, there is another troubling situation on the rise. A surge of children diagnosed with a combination of COVID-19 and the respiratory syncytial virus known as RSV. According to NPR, pediatric hospitals in Texas and around the country are reporting unseasonably early outbreaks of RSV, as infections typically occur in the late fall, winter, and early spring. RSV is a respiratory virus that mostly manifests as mild illness with cold-like symptoms in adults, but can cause pneumonia and bronchiolitis in very young children. The CDC reports it can be life-threatening in infants and young adults. Recently, at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston, 25 of 45 hospitalized pediatric patients were diagnosed with RSV as well as COVID-19. Officials report that the hospitalization rate is much higher than for either virus alone. At the moment, there is little data available on the impact of contracting both viruses and whether the two together can make a person sicker. But health officials worry it could put young patients who are not yet eligible for the vaccine at greater risk. Dr. Pia Panaraj, an infectious disease specialist at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, said last year during all of the COVID-19 outbreaks and all of our social restriction measures, we did not see RSV as the way we normally see it. The absence of widespread RSV last season means that babies up until a year and a half or 2 years of life are at risk. And the meaning behind that is because they don't have antibodies for RSV. She also explained that parents and doctors will have to be extra vigilant for symptoms, including coughing, lack of appetite, and excessive sleeping and lethargy. They can also suddenly stop breathing. In addition, the symptoms of RSV are similar to those of COVID-19, so parents and physicians need to look out for both of these infections. One bright spot in this story is that experts believe health officials will see a decline in RSV infections in places that are renewing indoor mask mandates and social distancing. We can make a huge difference in the level of viruses circulating if we all do our part to protect children and get vaccinated, socially distance, and wear masks. COVID-19 booster shots for the immunocompromised. The FDA has approved the emergency use of both the Pfizer and Moderna COVID-19 vaccines in order to protect groups most likely to benefit from an additional shot of the vaccine. These are people with compromised immune systems or with immune deficiencies who are consequently more at risk of long-term serious illness from COVID-19. People who are immunocompromised make up about 3% of the total U.S. population and include those with a history of cancer, organ transplants, poorly controlled HIV in people living with HIV, and those who have used certain medications such as steroids. After the FDA approved the use of booster vaccinations, a day later, the CDC gave their final approval to administer these shots. In a statement, the CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, said that at a time when the Delta variant is surging, an additional vaccine dose for some people with weakened immune systems could help prevent serious and possibly life-threatening COVID-19 cases within this population. For people whose bodies have not provided an adequate immune response to the standard doses of vaccines, these boosters will help refresh a waning immune response and help the body fight evolving pathogens. Dr. Dori Segev of the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University has said around half of all organ transplant patients have little antibody response to the current standard dosage of vaccines. However, in around half of the people his team studied, immune responses were better after an additional shot of the vaccine. CNN states that in September, the Biden administration is expected to lay out plans on COVID booster strategy for all Americans, with a phased rollout starting with the most vulnerable. The director of the National Institutes for Health, Dr. Francis Collins, said the U.S. could look to other countries that started their vaccine rollout a little earlier, such as the U.K., to help predict future vaccination plans. In July, the UK's Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunization announced plans to give immunocompromised people a third shot as early as September of this year as part of their autumn-winter phase three vaccination plan, stating that a synergistic approach to COVID-19 and influenza vaccination could support delivery and maximize uptake of both vaccines. Putting plans in place now to give the immune system boosters for those with weakened immune systems is important to save lives, particularly with the transmission of COVID-19 variants and before the winter flu season arrives. Man assembles hand washing station for the homeless. Now, millions of people around the world are washing their hands more frequently to avoid contracting the coronavirus. It's an act that most of us do without a second thought, and I'm happy, happy, happy to know that so many people are washing their hands now.
Yeah, but let's go back. Let's fast rewind back 2 years, a year before all this started.
That's fast rewinding backwards.
You wanted people to wash our hands, but you said that you were a big proponent of hand sanitizing.
Right. I still am.
Because, you know, unfortunately, some of us don't have the luxury of being able to wash our hands.
That's right.
With soap and water. An Atlanta resident, Terrence Lester, decided to help the city's homeless population by placing portable hand washing stations throughout that region. According to ABC News, Lester came up with an idea as the pandemic began because he knew the underserved needed assistance during this time of crisis. As he was once homeless himself, he firsthand knew the challenges of trying to remain healthy on the streets.
Mm. Now, people who sleep outside or in areas not meant for human habitation are at increased risk of contracting coronavirus. Lester is the co-founder of Love Beyond Walls, a nonprofit that advocates for those experiencing homelessness. With the help of volunteers, more than a dozen portable sinks have already been set up throughout Atlanta.
Lester said, "It's needed now more than ever. If libraries, restaurants, and other public spaces are all closed, then how would people who live on the streets get access to water? Doc, that's a point that I was making earlier. You were a big proponent of hand sanitizer mm-hmm. as opposed to water.
That's right.
And soap. These people are a part of the community, whether they have a home or not. Each hand washing station is filled with soap and holds anywhere from 5 to 10 gallons of water. Lester and the Love Beyond Walls volunteers clean and refill each unit daily."
That's great. New York City, Austin, Texas, and Oakland, California are among the cities that have recently agreed to join the initiative and provide portable sinks for homeless individuals. It's important to remember that those experiencing homelessness are people and not a problem that needs to be solved. So safe hand washing should be affordable for everyone, especially in a global pandemic. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Dari and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Dari or at DRDERY. You can follow us at Noise Filter on Instagram, Noise Filter NOLA on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right. We'll be right back.
to Community Radio.
KBOO, Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website.